Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, in cooperation with the American Textbook Publishers Institute, presents College Authors Forum. The series of programs offers discussions with authors about their writings and teachings, and offers informative insights into the realm of ideas which these men commit to paper. Today we travel to the University of Florida for talk with William G. Carleton. His book has been published by Random House.
We have with us in the studio Dr. William G. Carleton, author of the book The Revolution in American Foreign Policy, Its Global Range, published by Random House in late 1963. Dr. Carleton, we'd like to welcome you to our microphone. And I'd like to start off our questioning by asking you, what do you mean by the revolution in American foreign policy?
Well, briefly, the leap into world leadership by the United States during and following World War II. Our leap was unique. No nation had ever before moved so rapidly and abruptly to world leadership. No previous world leader had ever before attempted to do so much in all parts of the world after it became the world leader. The book deals with conditions in all parts of the world since 1945, Europe, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and how the United States has attempted to deal with those conditions.
Dr. Carleton, do you think there'll be another revolution in American foreign policy, or is something like that happening now?
No, the revolution has occurred, and it won't be undone or require a new one. But the conditions existing after World War II are changing rapidly. The stereotypes we developed in the immediate post-war years will no longer do. We are at a watershed. We must rethink foreign policy, adjust our ideas to the new conditions which are now emerging.
What do you mean by new conditions? How has the world changed?
Well, in the post-war years, the world was politically bipolarized. On one side, as you know, was the communist bloc led by Russia. On the other side, the non-communist bloc led by the United States. Never before had there been so rigid a lineup of the powers on so tight and clear-cut an ideological basis. But today, the situation is more fluid. Now the world has moved to depolarization, a more multiple diplomacy, more pluralism, more diversity. For instance, scores and scores of new nations with mixed economies have emerged in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. Most of them are neutral and refuse to join either bloc. More significant in recent years, our Western allies, our allies in Western Europe, no longer follow Washington as closely as they did. They're more independent in their policies. De Gaulle is the most conspicuous example of this, but there are other examples. Our Western European allies have recovered economically. They are no longer dependent on the United States. They have come to believe that there is less likelihood or little likelihood of war, and in any event, that they will be protected by the American nuclear deterrent. So they have become less amenable to United States direction or suggestion. But the communist bloc is even more divided. First, Tito broke away from the communist bloc. Then Gomulka's Poland attained considerable degree of independence. Now other Eastern satellites are following more or less Gomulka's example. And then, the climax, there is the dramatic rift between the two communist giants, Russia and Red China. Differences in national interest are proving more important than common communist ideology. But specifically, on the side of Russia, for instance, a number of reasons are producing this rift. You must remember the Russian Revolution is now nearly a half century old, and revolutions have a way of slowing down with age. They become less revolutionary. Their revolutionary fervor and evangelism abates. Russia is now a nation. As Barbara Ward has pointed out, on the basis of her per capita income, she's now one of the rich nations. Russia has giant industrial and technological developments. In other words, Russia wants to preserve, to conserve, to keep. Then again, each year, Russians more and more make contacts with the West. Those contacts have been increasing. And whatever the Russians may say, I don't believe they any longer really believe that the Americans are warmongers and aggressive imperialists. And I think they have come to believe that a grand war, grand climax between capitalist and communist countries is no longer inevitable. Then I think the Russians are accepting the implications of the nuclear revolution in war. They no longer believe that either side could win such a war, that the devastation would be so overwhelming that both sides would lose. So they're coming to look at the contest between communism and capitalism as being waged less on military and more on economic grounds. Now as to their attitude toward the Chinese, looking a little into the future, I believe the Russians fear a powerful China, and China is growing little by little, gradually, painfully, to become an industrial nation. And I believe that they fear that a powerful China would or might want to liquidate what remains of Russian concessions in Manchuria and Sinkiang, which go back to Tsarist days, that a powerful China might want to recover control of Outer Mongolia, which is now a Russian satellite, that a powerful China might even want to recover the maritime province in Vladivostok, which were taken by Tsarist Russia from China way back in 1860. Then, too, remember the Chinese population is increasing rapidly. There's a population explosion there. And a powerful China might want to expand over Siberia's wide open spaces. Then we ought to remember, too, that Russia is, after all, Western in its culture. Russians regard even Siberia as Western. And they have a saying that the Orient begins beyond Vladivostok, beyond the Amur River. And then this is something that most of us overlook. Repeatedly through Russian history, their most traumatic experiences, their longest, their most intense traumatic experiences, have come from the Mongolian invasions from the east. This has been basic in their history, and it's a fear bred in their bones, more or less.
Well, what of the Red Chinese? What is their attitude?
Oh, yes, I about forget about how the Chinese looked at this. I was giving this from the Russian point of view. Well, now remember, a communist revolution in China is much more recent than the communist revolution in Russia. The Chinese still have a great deal of revolutionary evangelism, enthusiasm. Also, the Chinese communists are at the beginning of their industrial revolution. They haven't made the industrial breakthrough as have the Russians. They are in the period of hard industrialization where they must use the severe methods of Stalinism, and they don't want Stalinism condemned. Then, too, the Chinese communists have been much more isolated from the world than the Russians. They've not had the contacts with the West the Russians have. They still believe that the Western capitalists are aggressive imperialists and warmongers, and that a grand showdown, a grand apocalypse between East and West, communist and capitalism, may be inevitable.
Well, don't you think, though, that Russia and China will get back together again? After all, as communists, don't they in the long run tend to look at things the same way?
There are contingencies which might bring Russia and China back into firm alliance. At the present time, the Russians don't want the communist regime in China to fall. They may fear an increasingly powerful communist China, but they would fear an anti-communist Chinese government still more.
Dr. Carlton, you think then that the breach between Russia and Red China is the most important development in world politics today?
Well, it's the most important development in current power politics, undoubtedly. But there is something even more important than that.
What is that?
Well, nothing short of a revolution in the nature of international relations produced by the nuclear revolution in war. The fear of nuclear holocaust is at last banishing force from international relations. This is a stupendous revolution in international relations, for hitherto the great and the ultimate decisions have often been made by war and force. In other words, we seem to be in the era of the Pax Atomica. Now notice, with all our colossal technological developments in war, our warheads, our nuclear weapons, our missiles, today, private guerrilla wars now seem to be the only safe form of force. The big powers are afraid to intervene too much or too directly in guerrilla wars, for they fear this will escalate into the so-called limited wars we had in Korea and Indochina in the early 1950s. And that such limited wars, in turn, will escalate into the big nuclear war. Notice, the big powers still march to the brink, but there is always a last-minute recoil. Witness Kamoi, Laos, Congo, Cuba, Berlin. And notice, too, that this recoil takes place not only on the part of Russia, not only on the part of the United States, but by Red China also, as at Kamoi, as at Matsu, as at the Himalayan border dispute with China. The international status quo is being frozen. How are we going to get the ultimate decisions and changes formerly we got through war? We are faced squarely with having to develop international peaceful political machinery to achieve the changes, the desirable changes, the necessary changes, formerly achieved by force and war.
Does your book discuss all these new trends that we've been talking about here?
Well, most of these topics are discussed explicitly, but some of them that had not emerged clearly when the book went to press are nonetheless anticipated, suggested, and implicit in the narrative of events.
What can the American people do to help American foreign policy?
Well, I think the main thing is that they not be captives of post-war stereotypes, but again, think through foreign policy in response to the new, the emerging conditions, and adjust and adapt the specific measures of foreign policy to these changes. I would like to see the campaign of 1964 turned into an educational campaign, wherein the politicians did not exploit the old stereotypes, but used the campaign as an opportunity to educate the people in the new trends and conditions which are emerging.
Dr. William G. Carlton, author of the book, The Revolution in American Foreign Policy, Its Global Range, published by Random House in late 1963.
The Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, in cooperation with the American Textbook Publishers Institute, has presented College Authors Forum. The series of programs offers discussions with authors about their writings and teachings, and offers informative insights into the realm of ideas which these men commit to paper. This program is produced for IBS by WAMU-FM, the American University in Washington, D.C. This is the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System.